that in the last 2 years, in order to be able to make maximum use of the time allotted and yet give you time for your storm, for anything else that you have to do later in the evening, and not spend time with some people waiting for other people to come. For those of you who are familiar with the program will forgive my just giving a 1 minute synopsis of how this works for those students for whom this is new. The idea of the dorm talks, which comes from Rabbi Chaifetz, who also coordinates the program, is to use the dormitories as a base for getting students from different shiurim, from different Jewish studies divisions, to come to a setting in which issues which are either relevant to many people now or will become relevant a little bit later in their lives can be discussed and analyzed, and they should be given the opportunity of hearing the perspective from one or two Rosh Yeshiva and how they view these issues. This year, the pre-discussion was done in the dormitories with the dorm counselors, and whoever participated didn't. And so therefore, we're assuming that the bulk of you have familiarity with the particular topics here, and therefore we can move right on to dealing with it. Structurally, Rav Schechter will be speaking. My role here is sort of a dual one. Normally, when I'm a moderator, I say nothing specific on any of the topics. I choose the moderator's prerogative not to speak. But here I got myself with a hyphen, so I can. And Mirza Shem will make some comments. So primarily you'll be hearing from Rav Schechter. We'll deal with one topic at a time, and then the floor will be open for a couple of questions or comments, which Rav Schechter and myself will respond to, and we'll move on. Our goal, Mirza Shem, is to complete the first part of the program before 9:30, to give you an opportunity to get back in a setting of the dorm floors, and then to see if you've gained any new insight in the same issues that we discussed before, and see how your thinking has been affected by the process. We will try to give time for questions. Again, hopefully if things go quickly enough, after we complete all the topics, there'll be a few more minutes for questions. We will end in time to Daven Maariv, since it's next door. We don't have to go away from the Beis Medrash to Daven Maariv. We'll have to make the strict 10 o'clock limit, because we know when the Beis Medrash will start davening. And Rav Schechter has agreed, and I will also stay afterwards for those who want to discuss things after the program is formally over. You know, we're not running home, but the program then will be been completed, so those who feel that they've heard the program and want to go on can go on. There are many people who cooperated making the program, but their program notes that lists all the names. So they will forgive me for not repeating their names. You look on the program notes and thank them all. Okay. Yeah. Rabbi Chaifetz reminded me that after the last program, when we saw that we didn't want to get people together afterwards, that we will rather, after we complete the initial round, open it up for questions and discussion for the entire group. I stand corrected. I trust that I don't have to introduce Rav Schechter or Shiv Meshkola, the Talmidim of the Yeshiva, Rav Schechter. You can read it to it, just, you know, refer to it, you know. The first topic we'll deal with is the one called Old Friends, which you should have on the, well, assuming this is the front side of the sheet on top.
Okay. There's more copies. I would assume that in different stages in people's lives they move on, and even if you had a lot of friends in your elementary school, when you go to high school, you develop different friends, and you go to college, you develop different friends, and you don't necessarily carry over all the friendships from Shalom Kadmonia. Then when you go there, so you develop different friends, and you lose old friends. You don't lose relatives, but you can lose their friendships. I don't really see why it's necessary for the person in the case history. It says when he looks into his future, he cannot help but think of their involvement. Why can he not help but think of their involvement if he no longer has any connection with them? Of course, we have an obligation to try to bring the care of everybody. We have more of an obligation to try to bring the care of our relatives. If you have relatives who are not observant, so there's more of an obligation to start to help us out. More of an obligation to try to bring the care of them. I guess it would depend whether he feels that he has a chance of how good a chance does he have of having hashpo on them. He may not have a hashpo on them that he'll get them to come to become shomer mitzvahs, but if you can have a hashpo, they shouldn't intermarry. At least they shouldn't intermarry or something, you know. Even an elementary hashpo also, he should maintain a friendship. It doesn't have to be the same degree of friendship that it used to be. I think that the slight level of friendship would be sufficient for that. I don't see that it should be a difference whether these people are relatives. There is a slight difference. I mean, the obligation between the car is relatives is more so than the obligation between the car outside. But as far as this case is concerned, I don't really see that much of a difference between relative and friend. My feeling would be, I have relatives who are not observant, and I have no shaykhahs with them. I don't feel that I'm in a position to be the car of them. So I guess I don't. So I let someone else be the car.
Okay. The time factors, because I know that no matter how quickly Rav Shekhar speaks, the questions come up when you have the full time. I think we have to be terribly concerned that we won't. I asked Rav Shekhar not to bother reading the question. You assume that you're familiar with it. Are there any questions or comments that people want to make? Change his mind. Right. Yes.
You have to. You shouldn't make any efforts to remake the friendships. But is there a problem possibly with breaking friendships, which they expect to be, or making a statement about breaking?
I don't think it's necessary to make an official declaration that because you're no longer observant, that because you don't believe in God anymore, so therefore, people just move on in life. After you get married, you're going to have different friends also. Then you're going to move to a different city, you're going to develop different friends. Some of the old friendships will be maintained. Most of them will not be maintained. Just people move on in life and they develop different friends. I think a person who learned in Eretz Yisrael goes to YU and he's going in one route, and his two cousins are his two former friends whom he was friendly with the last 20 years. Going in a completely different direction, so it's understood that he no longer is friendly with them. Of course, when they'll have a family bar mitzvah, so he'll participate superficially in whatever family get together on Hanukkah once every 4 or 5 years, he'll participate. But more than that, I don't think it's proper that he should maintain the friendship. That's not proper to maintain the friendship and not observe anything else.
Those of you who come late, the price one has to pay is you to sit up front, because those RECs are still empty. Yes.
One worry about sending them, let's say, and if they call them, like, they'll get it back, you know. One worry about, you know, are you supposed to just say, I'm sorry, I can't speak any longer, and then...
I don't think it's necessary to offend them. You speak a little bit, but then you'll be busy in yeshiva, and they'll get the hint, they'll understand on their own that you're in a different position, in a different situation. I think it's understood that when you can...
Yes.
I think these are pretty specific cases, but how about the old friends that are now in YU? That are
same thing. YU is a big city.
No.
It's not possible to maintain friendship with everybody. I don't even know all my students' names. Most of the students are not in my class. It's not possible. So even in YU, if you have friends for the last 20 years, you know, YU,
there are a lot of uncomfortable situations that come up.
So you should. I think a person should try to avoid as much as possible. That's the opening chapter in Sefer Tehillim, that David HaMelech says you have to be very careful not to hang out with non-observant people or people who are not medaktik in the mitzvahs to the extent that you are. If you want to maintain a certain religious level, you have to be very careful about your friends. People don't realize how much they are influenced by their friends. A very subtle influence, and little by little, a person can change completely. No one should think that he's so strong in his opinions, and he's so stark in his amunah, and his shmiras hamitzvahs, that he won't be influenced by the outside world, by his friends. Not so. friends have a tremendous influence on people. That's why there's a special din in the Torah that you have to be friendly with Talmidei Chachamim, by Sidbok, and you have to be very careful not to be friendly with non-Jews or non-observant Jews. Same thing. Yeah.
How
do you expect, if all non-observant Jews have no friends who are observant, how do you expect them to get any kishmak? If you feel that you have it, we can't be mashpia on everybody, but if you feel that you have kishmanis, you have talents, and you have that in mind, you're making a conscious effort to be mashpia on other people, so then that's what the whole NCSY is based on. So then it's permitted and required, not only recommended, it's required that you should go into that field. You should try to do that.
But I mean, I just think that personal, like friend to friend, relationship, not in an organized way. Like, just you know somebody who's not, that from, but.
I know a lot of people. In my building, I know a lot of people who are not from. Most of the people in my apartment building are not from. So I say hello, goodbye, good chance, So I'm not really friendly with them. And I have a superficial hashpah on them. They know that I'm religious, if there's any issue, they have their acharis, and I'm a chal shabbos in my presence, and so on. They know. But for that type of a hashpah, that you don't have to be very friendly with them. If you want to have a, if you feel that you have the ability to have a heavy hashpah, and you want to have such hashpah, so if you enter such a relationship consciously, planning to have such hashpah on people, so then if you're assessing yourself properly, then it's permissible and recommended, required, that you should do it.
Okay, we'll just take for one more question on this one, because otherwise we'll spend the whole matter Wednesday. Yeah.
Well, in terms of assessing yourself, and whether you can have hashpah and so on, is it more of a, how can you just, sometimes you like you're in general, like, you're supposed to look for Ras and tell you, or but basically sometimes you really will know you too well. How do you?
Yeah, people usually assess themselves much greater. Yeah, people think that they're much smarter than they really are. When we dab and say, we're asking always for the other fella, he needs a little favor. We gotta have in mind ourselves. No. So, I don't know, you're ready, you should speak to Mashgiach.
Yeah, well, speak to. You don't have someone who really knows you.
You have a serious thought. You have to think very seriously before you go into the cure of work, because it's a very high level of charity to give what you don't have. So if you don't really have a lot of shemayim, a lot of emunah, then you won't be able to give too much to the other person. You have to make sure that you have a lot and you have a lot of strength, that you should be able, something should be able to rub off on the other. That's a big, that's a very questionable area. How does one assess? It's very difficult there. How does one assess himself, whether he really has the kishrayim to go into kiruv?
I just point out that the problem of how one assesses himself is a problem that one could raise on any topic, and every area, and every time in life. And to a certain degree, part of self-development involves simply learning how to assess oneself. As we think of development, I'm going to learn how to learn better, I'm going to do this better, I'm going to do that better. I was going to know part of growth, part of responsibility we have is to know ourselves, to know our strengths and our weaknesses, which enable us to then to work on the weaknesses and take advantage of the strengths. And so that's a general situation. It is true, using the context of this particular question, that for a fellow 18, 19 years old, you know, is still in the process and he's not sure of who he is. And that plays a role in contact with people who had been his friends. And if he feels he's changed, then he's concerned on one end of being brought down by them because they've moved in a different direction, or they've not moved with him, let's say, in an upward direction. And on the other hand, it's a very funny business. I mean, some of you have heard me give a talk to, last year I gave a talk to potential advisors for the various kiruv programs. It is very strange, but it so happens in certain kinds of kiruv work, 19-year-old kids are better than 50-year-old rabbanim. Even though the 50-year-old rabbanim know so much more and have so much more experience, but in the area of communication with a 15-year-old kid or another 19-year-old kid, it's very possible that someone of a closer age can break through faster. Right. You notice we don't. All the youth programs don't run with adult advisors. They work with advisors a few years old. So, one on one hand, should not fall in the trap of overestimating one's ability and not be cognizant of the risks. On the other hand, one has to be aware that sometimes one does have ability. One can undersell himself, you know, as well. All right.
Just as a footnote to the one's overestimating one's ability, someone told me, Amai said that Dr. Twersky, the psychiatrist from Pennsylvania, visited the Stifler many years ago. And he told me he's a psychiatrist, and he takes care of Mishigoyim, explained what a psychiatrist is. So the Stifler supposedly asked Twersky, do you have any medication to treat people who have hallucinations of grandeur, that they think that the greatest development in the world? So he said they're working on it. So he said, please work on it very fast, because in my opinion, that's the biggest machla that there is around today. There are not only people 19 years old who don't know where they are, there are people 65 years old who also think that they're much greater than they are. They don't know how to assess themselves, not just on teenagers.
Okay. The next is really two related questions that we formulated in similar but somewhat separate form. For those who have not yet gone to Eretz Yisrael, which I assume almost everyone who hasn't gone is planning to do so. So I don't know if you can appreciate, unless you have an older brother who's done it beforehand, how dramatic an impact that year or two or three often is on someone's life. And that the feeling of kesher with Eretz Yisrael and the need, both halachically and personally, to go back and to fulfill one's life there is very strong. Yet that comes in conflict sometimes with different kinds of personal dreams. On one level, one has had the first part of the question deals with a person who always dreamt to be a doctor. He feels a doctor, one of things, I'll save lives. And everybody in Israel tells him, we have Russian doctors coming out of every plane. We have more doctors than patients. We can't handle any more doctors. So Israel means no doctors. That's the first point. The second part of the question deals with the fact that many Americans involved in Chinuch Rabbanis who go to Eretz Israel and have to deal with Israelis who are part of a different culture and a different primary language of expression feel they can't be as effective. And if they really want to accomplish in teaching Torah, in whatever form it may be, they need to be in a setting where they'll be most effective. And that becomes a reason or a rationale for one spending one's life in America. How does one weigh these considerations? I get the easy part. I define the question. Jack does give answers.
I'll give suggestions. I'm not going to give the answers. I'll give mahalach. I was telling Rabbi Chaifetz earlier that just last year, Rabbi Aaron Silver from Eretz Yisrael, from Karim Yavin, some of you may know him, spoke to me about a situation. He had an acquaintance of his had made Aliyah and was a top-notch accountant in America. And in Israel, he already had grown children. He was married, I guess, 15 years. Had a few children already, and he couldn't get a job in Eretz Israel in his field of expertise in being an accountant. He was there for a few years, and nothing was working out for him. If he would come back to America, he'd be able to get a top-notch job in some accounting firm. And in Eretz Israel, he could get another job. He could wash floors in a hospital. He could be a mail carrier. He could learn the retirement, make more money. he could get some other parnasa, but that wasn't what he was trained for. So he wanted to know whether the person is obligated to stay this type of mishnah, the person is obligated to stay in Eretz Yisrael, or he's permitted to leave Eretz Yisrael. So the din of the Gemara seems to be, the din of the Shulchan Aruch seems to be that a person only has the mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. But the mitzvah is only if life will be with normal conditions. To live in Eretz Yisrael under abnormal conditions, one is not mechuyav to stay. For example, he wrote Boretz, Yerid Avram Mitzrayim Mitnei Rov. When there was a Rov in Eretz, he permitted to leave Eretz Yisrael. He permitted to leave in the days of the Shoftim also, there was a Rov, and they left Eretz Yisrael. They didn't know that you permitted to leave. Or the Gemara says you permitted to leave Lul Matara Belisa Isha, because not only Lul Matara, if there's no yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, even if there are yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael, but this guy is just crazy about one certain Rebbe who happens to be in Chutz Lortz. Alisa Isha, he's crazy about a certain girl who lives in America. There are a thousand girls, a million girls in Eretz Yisrael. So why can't he marry a girl there? No, but he had his heart set on this girl. So the Gemara says that even in such a case, he's permitted to leave Eretz Yisrael. and live a chutzlot, because that's considered, he doesn't have to break his heart. That's considered abnormal living. To live in Eretz Yisrael, he has to go marry someone other than the one that he really has loved. So if you have a situation where the person is already a practicing doctor for years, and he already has his parnasa worked out, and then he comes to Eretz Yisrael and it doesn't go, if he has a shot, should he become a janitor in the hospital and make a parnasa, or make a good parnasa, or should he come back to America? But then I would assume that that's considered an abnormal form of living. This is what he's used to. So let's say if a person lives in America, he's a Rebbe in America, makes, I teach him, I make $150,000. I go there, I'll teach in yeshiva, I'll make $10,000. But I'll live with the $10,000, I'll be able to live. So that's not considered abnormal. If he can live on the $10,000, it's good. So then that's not considered abnormal, just because I live here in such tremendous luxury and everything. And there I'll just live a normal life. That's not considered abnormal. But abnormal, if the guy's going to have to switch his profession, he's used to this kind of a field, he's going to go become a different, go enter into a different profession. That's not his profession. The only question is, what about a fellow who always dreamt that he's going to become a doctor? So exactly how strong are these dreams? People a lot of times have dreams up until they graduate college, and then they realize that they're going to go into a different field. So maybe the dreams are not so serious. You can sometimes have a hatavas chalom. You have a dream. You can break off the dream. So I would imagine that the Gemara does speak about the fact that the Rebbeinu Shlom sheds three tears every day about different things, and two out of the three tears that the Rebbeinu Shlom sheds every day, the Gemara says, is about the misplaced people. The people go into the wrong field. Some people go into chinuch, into learning, and they don't belong there. They belong in other fields. Some people go into secular fields, and they belong in learning. And who are dinami, some people go into medicine and they really belong in accounting, and other people go in accounting and they really belong in medicine. Different. So that's a tragedy that the Gemara considers, whatever that expression is. The Rebbeinu Shlom cries about that every day of the year, 354 days a year. He cries about the fact that people are misplaced, that they don't go into the field. A human being not just has to make a parnasa and have food and clothing for his children. He has to go into the field that he's cut out, into the work that he's cut out to do. The question is, if a person had dreams from his childhood on to become a doctor, it doesn't necessarily mean that he has to become a doctor. Maybe he can change his plan and go into some other field. So I would assume that it depends how strong his feeling is. If he's going to go into a different field other than medicine, will he really be heartbroken? Like he fell in love with this girl, and now you're going to tell him, no, stay in Eretz Yisrael, marry a different girl. So he's really going to be heartbroken. At least for a while, he's going to be heartbroken. Maybe later on he'll overcome it. But so to be heartbroken, you're not mechuyev. Yeah, so the question is, how much of a heartbreak will it be to go into a different field? I would assume that that's what should determine the first issue. The second case is a very serious question. The Maharam Shik had a student. The Maharam Shik was a Talmud of the Chasam Sofer, and they were fighting reform in Hungary at that time. And he had a student who was in the rabbinate in Hungary, who was fighting the reform movement. They were maintaining, holding groshes and so on, maintaining the religious level of their community. And this Talmud of his was offered a position in Eretz Yisrael, so a long time ago, where he would be able to be a rav and a community and paschal shaylis and give shiurim and learn. That's what he always wanted. He didn't want to give these sermons with these groshes with all this superficial colonial with the rabbinate. He wanted to sit and learn. So he sent a letter to his rebbe that he got the shtela in Eretz Yisrael, and he's packing his bags and he's leaving. Will the rebbe give him a bracha? So he sent him back a letter. If you want a bracha, the question is, whether you're doing the right thing? I think that you're not allowed to leave. And because he paskin the gal that he's not allowed to leave, so he included this letter in the Tshuvas Maharam Shik, which he published, in Chelik Yerudei, in Hilchas Tam Ter. So he writes that nobody twisted your arm initially to join the rabbinate. If you wanted to, you could have done whatever you would be cut out for. But once he decided to join the rabbinate, even if the second mitzvah is much greater, 10 times greater than the first mitzvah, you're not permitted to leave the first mitzvah alone and to go to another mitzvah. And he quotes the Ritva in Sukkah, the famous Ritva at the end of the second prayer. Patam ha-mitzvah means that it's asa. Once you're involved in the first mitzvah, you're not permitted to be mafsik the first mitzvah to do the second mitzvah, because you're patam from the second mitzvah. It's like a dvar hashus. It's like leaving and neglecting a mitzvah in order to do a dvar hashus, which is an optional thing. So he says that no one forced you to join the rabbit in Hungary, which really is involved like MCSY, where you're fighting reform. But if you join the ready, then you're not permitted to leave to go to Eretz Yisrael, because Eretz Yisrael will be a different kind of a rabbit. At that time, the rabbin it was, that you learn and you pass the shilas and you give shiurim, there's a different thing. It's a different mitzvah. It's a gewaldige mitzvah. Maybe it's a bigger mitzvah than fighting reform, together with living in Eretz Yisrael. For sure it's a bigger mitzvah maybe than fighting reform, but he says, once you're doing this mitzvah, so you're not permitted to leave. This was, that was one hezbo that he gives. So he said, it's a fatman al mitzvah and it's also lahat. Then he gives another time, and he says, well, fighting reform is like a melchama. And he says, that's one of the rules of melchama, that you have to, the captain of the ship has to stay on the ship. He's not allowed to abandon the ship. He said, you have to fight till the end. You have to stay here in your community and fight till the end. And he writes the way the Chassam Sofer, that's the famous source of that story. His Rebbe, the Chassam Sofer, was a rabbi in Pressburg, and he was offered a position in a bigger and a better community somewhere at this different place. Somewhere else in Europe. And he was really interested in leaving, and then the Balabatim from Pressburg came to him and they said, Rebbe, who's going to be the rabbi in Pressburg? They're going to get another rabbi, what's the big deal? But they said, no, you are so forceful in fighting the reform. No one's going to be as successful as you are. Who's going to fight the reform? So that's why the Chassam Sofer was convinced that he has to stay, because he realized that no one would be able to be Mamali Mikomo in that one area. So that's what this Nakuda is, what Rabbi Soloveitchik, the Rav, always used to say for many years. The Rabbanim in America would be interested in packing up when they had it from the Balabatim, as the Rabbanim have at some time or another. So they would be interested in leaving Eretz Yisrael and going to the Rabbanim there, or whatever, Chinuch over there. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, no, but here you're fighting reform and you have to fight to the end, some Chama you have to stay to the end. The question is, well, that's because you're already involved, you already joined the Rabbanim in America. What if the person is a college student? He didn't join anything yet, he didn't make up his mind yet what he wants to do. Should he choose business or should he choose a career in Chinuch HaRabban? So that's a stomach question. Leave out there. It's Yisrael. No, it's Yisrael. Stomach question. 25 years ago, before Kedem HaPitar, before anybody went there, Yisrael, my time, nobody went to learn there. It's Yisrael. 25 years ago, 30 years ago. So the Shaila was, should a person choose a career in business or a career in Chinuch? So it depends what he's cut out for. Some people are in Chinuch and it's an absolute disaster. They don't know how to teach. Some people are Rabbanis and it's an absolute disaster. They're not cut out for Rabbanis. They should have in Shul Beitza by somebody, they should have consulted by their associates, or by the Rabbein and Yeshiva, by the Mashgiach, or someone to discuss whether they really cut out or not. But if a person is cut out for Chinuch or Rabbanus, equally cut out for Chinuch or Rabbanus or business, so I would think he should certainly choose Chinuch or Rabbanus, even if he may not make so much panos. You know? Why you would make $150,000 a year? You should make a little more, a little less. If I win, I think they pay more. I mean, seems to pay a little less, but no one's starving to death. Everybody in Chinuch HaRabbanus does pretty well, Baruch Hashem. So, if a person feels equally capable of going into a business or going into Chinuch HaRabbanus, he certainly should go into Avodas HaKadosh. Why not? There's a tremendous need for these kind of people, whether here or in Eretz Yisrael. The question is, if it's the way it's presented, should he go into... He'll be more successful if he goes into Chinuch HaRabbanus in America than if he does Chinuch HaRabbanus in Eretz Yisrael. So that... A person should reassess that. That may not necessarily be so. There are many Americans. We speak English. We don't speak Hebrew so well, so we won't be so successful in Chinuch HaRabbanus and so. There's so many Americans in Eretz Yisrael. A person could do the same kind of cure of activity that he does in America in a parallel situation in Eretz Yisrael. It means if he can't find such a situation. So if the alternative is whether he should go into Chinuch HaRabbanus in America or go into business in Eretz Yisrael because of the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael, I don't know about that. It was a while that Rav Chaim Moshe, Rav Kook, the first chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, had negotiated with Rav Chaim Moshe by mail that he should come move to Eretz Yisrael, and they were negotiating to buy a home for him, and they were going to give him a position with a salary, and going to do something there in Eretz Yisrael, to work on Shilas, of course, and so on. And he was holding up by going to Eretz Yisrael. And then he sent a letter to Rav Kook, and he changed his mind because he realized that they needed him more where he was in Europe than in Eretz Yisrael. Then you can't really say Ha'isik for mitzvah, patam and ha'mitzvah, he's patam for living in Eretz Yisrael, because it's Ha'isik in the mitzvah of passing in Shilas. It would be the same Rav Chaim Moshe, he would pass from the same Shilas in Eretz Yisrael. But he thought that was more his makam. He was accomplishing more in Europe than he was in Eretz Yisrael. This is also, Rav Soloveitchik used to say, it's also a serious consideration. That a person is cut out for Chinuch HaRabbanus, and he can do a good job in America, is takanat right that he goes to Eretz Yisrael and he goes into business. Isn't the whole mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael is that that's our makam. That's everybody. The Torah said that's where the Jews belong in Eretz Yisrael. That's our makam. But if you can accomplish so much in Chutz Laaretz, so this is your mokum, that's not your mokum. I remember around 8-9 years ago, I was in Eretz Yisrael for 3 months in the summertime. So somebody took me to visit the chief rabbi, Rabbi Avraham Shapiro. He was the chief rabbi then. It's a long time. Less, must have been 7, 8 years ago. It was a long time ago now. So someone took me to visit him. So he started giving me a whole drasha. I should come to Eretz Yisrael. The same speech that everybody gets. I should come to Eretz Yisrael, and I should get a job in a yeshiva, and he'll help me get a job. And if I want, he'll help me find my own yeshiva, and he'll make a kollel for me, and he'll raise money, and I'll get money. And he a whole drasha for 25 minutes, at least 25 minutes. And then he talks very quickly. Talks very quick, much quicker than I do. But he wants to slow down. He talks Yiddish. Then it's as fast as I talk English. When he talks Hebrew, then it's twice as fast as Yiddish. So then he says to me in Hebrew, he says, and by the way, how many, he said, I heard that you give a shiur for Balabatim. How many Balabatim come to your shiur? So I started reckoning ice. I say, this shiur and the other shiur, on a weekly basis, I used to say a lot of shiur, and on a monthly basis. So then he, after he heard all that, then he said, oh, then I don't know. Then he said, you got to think it over. Maybe you have to stay in America. And then he spent the next 25 minutes to convince me that I should stay in America. and he said at that time that he understands that that's the nature of the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael, is that that's the makom. Everybody has to be in the makom he belongs. That's where we all belong. But if it's clear and obvious that this is your makom, so you have to stay there. You shouldn't go. Moshe, the Mishnah says in Ksudas that everyone is supposed to move to Yerushalayim, as opposed to the rest of Eretz. Everyone should move to Eretz Yisrael, and everyone should move to Yerushalayim. So the Delta, how come the Chazon Ish didn't move to Yerushalayim? He had the opportunity to move to Yerushalayim. So obviously he must have felt that he's doing much more in there must have been very strong reasons why he felt that he's accomplishing much more in Bnei Brak than he could accomplish in Yerushalayim. So he felt, therefore, there's no mitzvah for him. There's no mitzvah to go to Yerushalayim and accomplish less. These are some of the considerations.
I'm sure people have some questions and comments. Yes.
Part of the beginning of the question was that you feel you've always achieved truth. Basically, that you feel that your own, not only the mitzvah, but you feel you'll reach, you'll be able to...
More observant Jew.
You'll reach higher levels in Israel, and we're here. So, it's not only, you know, so, can't leave out that part of the question. Not only is there a mitzvah you should excel.
That's a very serious consideration. It's relevant for the person and for his family as well. But that's often the case, that life in Eretz Yisrael is on a much higher level of religious observance than life in America. That's absolutely true. So if the person has such a strong feeling, then I would assume that his life's dream to become a doctor would probably vanish into thin air. If he really is so convinced, I would assume that he would change his mind. That he'll start dreaming to be a janitor in a hospital. or whatever they need. To be a Rosh Hashiva.
But point out, the question was put that way, with the also additional understanding that people just coming back from a couple of years in Eretz Yisrael, in a setting where this particular feeling has been inculcated to a certain degree, may or may not have an objective evaluation of the reality picture. I probably have an awkward situation, because I think the folks should go in general. But many people here, including many of the Rosh Hashivas and not only in this yeshiva, but many yeshivas in America, find that when a number of the boys, when they come back from Israel, they come up with a very simplistic notion of that somehow the Kedushas HaAretz is so pervasive that one automatically has all kinds of religious fulfillment, and there's no further analysis of specific situations, and you know, this is a given. Now, if you really learn that Torah properly, then you must come back feeling that leaving is a traitorous act, and that it's impossible to have any spiritual life of any serious dimension outside of Eretz Yisrael. And I don't think it's that simple. And it's a very difficult thing to say, because what happens usually is that the fellow, after he's back a year, is less convinced than he was before. And then says, "Ah, they're taken away from me because I'm not there. I don't experience the kedusha." When I was a Talmud in yeshiva, perhaps even further back than Shechta, I had a friend who was now a Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, who at the time went to learn America's Arav for a year. Weren't too many Americans went, but he went. And the next year he came back to yeshiva, and we agreed to have a seder in Machsheves Rav Kook. So we had a seder on Thursday afternoons for an hour in Machsheves Rav Kook. But I had a more philosophic bent than my friend. So I would ask a lot of questions, and since he wasn't oriented in this direction, he sometimes had difficulty in responding to the questions that I asked. And this would go on week after week, and he finally got very frustrated and explained to me that you can't understand the Machshavas of Kook and Chutzlah. You know, this is a true story. I think I don't question the spirituality of life in Israel. But I must tell you, when I talk to the fellows there, that a 19-year-old is so convinced that he understands the nature of spirituality after someone, a Rebbe of his in Israel, has been telling him for a year and a half that you won't get any spirituality in Chutzlar, it's so terrible, and only here, and that's coupled with an experience where at that point of his life, the only serious learning time has been in Israel. Because in America, he was in high school, and he was a different kind of kid. He wasn't as mature, and he had his high school secular classes. And in Israel, he's learning all day long. Sometimes it is possible to confuse the fact that one's in a very different experience, and one is learning, and assume that it's automatically a product of one being in Israel. Not to take away from Sushi Saris. Please understand, but it's sometimes simplistic to say, if they were taking, my yeshiva in Israel and put it somewhere in Africa, but separated from the world with other Ashpos, what role would the Kedushas Haaretz have played in it, and what role would have been the fact that I've made the decision to learn, and I'm in an environment that supports my learning, that didn't happen to have the specific Kedushas Haaretz. Now, recognizing the other side of the picture is that it's true. When one's back in America, when one's pulled back into old habits, one has parents usually want you to stay here. If they're here, obviously they want their children to be nearby. And the choice could be between the spirituality of Israel and the comforts in America. But the question is it necessarily so? Is it always so? Maybe so, but it's true in every case. It's just a question of spirituality versus physical comfort. Sometimes a fellow is willing to go into chinuch or go into rabbanis and willing to go to a difficult situation and sacrifice a lot of things in order to spread Torah, maybe making the choice on a different basis than simply the comforts of America. Yeah.
What about the dilemma that someone might face in terms of appeal to the earth that offers more to the Tefillah, the community in America, like being a water sort of chronic, and going to Eretz Yisrael, that would be lessened, and apart from the contribution to the Tefillah making Aliyah itself, he would only think he would gain in terms of contributing, but he feels his children would have their religious lifestyle, as opposed to the religious lifestyle his children would have in America as chronic. How do you balance that thing? In terms of living in America, with the Chanukah and the love, his children spoke language of the English, they'll be exposed to American history, as opposed to Jewish history, and spoken language of Hebrew and Arabic. So they won't be able to Chanukah for the love of Arabic. So how do you balance that?
It's such a good question. I'm very shocked to answer. No, seriously. No. You know, because that question, of course, can be generalized. And I'll put a spin on the question, not because I have an answer to the question. I'm sure you all deal with this. Shachter spoke about some of the factors that a person has to decide whether he's cut out to go in the chinuch or rabbanus. But another factor may be the impact on the family. I wrote a whole book about the problems of rabbis' children. Right? How hard it is and the pressures that they're under. I remember the first personal experience. I left yeshiva, my first position was in Brookline, Massachusetts. Right? And which is not really going out to the hinterlands terribly. But all my friends, who were all New Yorkers, and I was also born in Brooklyn, thought that I was Meshuggah. Right? We had a little baby. Where's he going to get the same kind of religious environment out there that he can get here in New York, you know, with all the Kedusha of New York City? But seriously, I was going out of town to a community where there was, certainly didn't have the same degree of choices of schools to send the child. We even had simple matters of the problem of, there was no Shomer Shabbos bakery, right? So man, all kinds of difficulties. My wife, you know, in terms of the baking and cooking, all the time that had to be spent on that, because we don't eat certain products from, you know, from the bakery that wasn't Shomer Shabbos. It was a much more difficult life, religiously, in many, many ways. And I gotta make a cheshbon, you know, I'm gonna go into computers, and I will, you know, be able to learn while the computer's working all day long. I put it into the machine, and it's cranking out, and I sit with my safer, right? And every few hours, I have to go correct a little bit here and there. I'm exaggerating, but assume if a guy's really good enough for computers, he can probably put a limited number of hours, right? And then I come home at night, and I have chavrusas, and I have such a wonderful place for my wife and my children. And my friend, so he's going to become a rav, and we're going to send him out to his initial position. He's not going to get a big shul in Manhattan. We're going to send him out to, they need him in Des Moines, Iowa, right? And he's going to be the only firm family in Des Moines. And what kind of life is going to be for his wife and children? So the question, while it has a specific content in terms of Israel, has a broader context also in terms of children. I'm told, this is Agni P.A., that in the early years of Lakewood, Rabban Kutler Zatzal was trying to convince the Talmud to go out in Chinuch, and he said, how can I go out in Chinuch, and what's going to do with my family? And Rabban gave him, I said, I'll take Achray. So I'm going to give you a bra, the Rach Vachay, that your children won't be negatively affected. Our Achray is to ourselves, and our Achray is to our children, is a complicated question. I mean, I know one place where the Gemara discusses it. Right? The Gemara gives a surprising answer. The Gemara Kedushin discusses who lilma dubno lilma. The Gemara's answer is who kodem. However, if the son has greater potential, after all, the son is only a youngster, and he has all these years that he can grow in Torah, and the father's already wasted all these years, and he's only going to reach a limited amount of potential, then b'no is kodem. But the fact is that the Gemara says that my achrayis, for my son's learning, it's a basic achrayis, does not outweigh my achrayis for myself. And that's assuming I have to make a difficult choice. So I'm not sure how one balances that, what we think is good for our children and what we think is good in terms of ourselves.
But
if you're assuming that it balances, you had a chance to ask me a harder question, make it easier, right? Right. If you're assuming that everything balances out, and then the children weigh it to one side, so there's no question anymore. I think that's a shot that an individual would really have to consult with. I don't think you can give a blanket kind of an answer. I mean, there is, as Rav Shachter pointed out in the first question, there's a notion of Tzorcha al-Tasala, that we have a greater achrayus to our own mishpacha than we have outside. But clearly, if we took that to the extreme, then no one would go out to work in outlying communities, because so there has to be some balancing of the needs of the kehila at large with the potential risk to one's immediate family.
I'll just mention some occurrence for the issue. It's very complicated. The Gemara has a principle at the beginning of the Zer Neshef. I don't even say this. The Gemara has Chayecha Kaidim LaChayecha Lercha. Whenever it's my life is in danger, his life is in danger. Two people walking in the desert, there's only a cup of water for one. So the Rishonim say in Kiddush, in the beginning of Perek Ra'imah, the Ritva quotes the name of Rabbeinu Tam, but only Hamhapet Becharor, and that Gemara, that Chayecha Kaidim LaChayecha Lercha is not only limited to that situation where my life is in danger, your life is in danger. It's a plow and all she put in midon of machaveiro. But I'm only mechuyim to do for you if it's not going to cause me any hassle. First, I take care of my own needs, and then after my own needs are all taken care of, then I take care of your needs. So they quoted the name of Rav Kook, Zechon of Racha, the chief rabbi Rav Kook, that he said that that plow hayecha kaidem lachayecha vercha doesn't apply b'shas machama. Let's say we're fighting a war, and the general sends a battalion of soldiers to go in. You know, the 10 guys in the first time for sure are going to get killed. The other battalion's going to go through, so maybe they will live, whatever, but the first couple of guys are sure going to, so the guys who say, I don't want to go. So Shas Muhammad, that thing clearly doesn't work. So he once made an assessment of the situation, so he said, we're fighting reform and so on, you're fighting Amaratzis, so it's also like a Tchina of a Muhammad, so Hayecha Kerem L'Chayech HaVecha doesn't apply. Yeah, but a little bit it does apply. So that's the problem. So you have to work out the details. That's like a very complicated issue.
Yes.
So the last question on that, my wife on the side. This 19-year-old boy is coming back from whatever, spent a couple of years more than you. Very simple, I guess, what he was, the learning area.